be a goose. Crack open the wine.
Hello, welcome to Butler's Podcast. Huzzah! Another episode.
Right, it's summer holidays, yes. So we thought people might like to listen to something slightly entertaining.
Yes, lightweight, light beat, upbeat.
Really, light beat, yes.
Yeah, light beat. Lightsaber. Yes, if you're on holiday, you might be a bit bored and might have your earphones in, trying to avoid other conversations. So this will be super entertaining.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Basically, Henry's done no preparation or paid any attention to this, like normal. And I decided that I would ask Henry some questions about wine that maybe we get asked when we're at tastings or when customers come into the shop, or just general popular questions to uncover some of the myths of wine.
Absolute muppet. So you do all
the
work.
Seeing as you're the expert.
And I do nothing. Okay.
So well, this is the, I ask the questions, you do all the answers.
I'm going to remain silent then, because
well, that's going to be fun then.
Nothing.
Fun for everyone.
Okay.
But you don't know what I'm going to ask you, do you?
No, and surely that's the point. So that's what we're going to do. And I will remain your performing monkey.
Well, let's just get you to focus, shall we? And sit still.
Feel the back of my hand in a minute.
Right.
Come on then, question one.
I've got 15 questions.
Okay.
And I tried
to
put them
in. Are they easy?
Well, they're interesting, hopefully.
Okay.
And there's a mixture of kind of wine production, wine, I don't know, just a mixture of stuff. Once I started writing them, I got quite carried away.
Okay.
But hopefully it'll be useful. Things that, tips that people could take away and then might help them when buying wines or looking for wines.
I'm quite good at relationship issues as well. So are there any questions on that?
Right. We're going into some sort of... No, we're not.
Question one.
Question one. How is wine made? What's the difference between red and white wine?
Oh, really?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know. Question two. I'm joking. So, for wine to be made, you need to have grapes from a recognised quality region.
Not the ones from the supermarket.
You can make a wine, but you wouldn't be able to sell it as a quality level wine. You wouldn't be able to sell it, really. But that would be a wine like someone might make out of parsnips or rhubarb or whatever people do.
They do that.
So you need sweet grapes because they are high in sugar. You need some yeast. So that might be natural yeast that's floating around in the vineyard or on the grape skins or just around. Or you can add yeast. You would need some temperature control to make sure that everything comes together nicely, but basically the process is that the yeast eats the sugar and turns that into alcohol and a byproduct of CO2, which is the sparkly nature. So it's the same as if you picked a bunch of apples and put them in a bucket, and you might be contemplating making cider or maybe not, and then in the warmth of your house, and with the yeast, natural yeast, on the apples, suddenly they start to bubble away in the pot. And that is fermentation. And you need fermentation to create wine.
That's so much more complicated than I thought you were going to say. Basically you crush the grapes and the juice that comes off is the clear stuff.
That's not wine, but okay, that's just grape juice. So if you make red wine, you crush the juice, you ferment it with
the
yeast, and you leave the juice on the skins of the red grapes, which is how you get the colour. With a lot of white wines, you crush the juice and... The juice comes off to the side and you make the wine out of the juice. And you don't leave it on the skins. That's generally how you do it.
Okay, that was quite complicated.
Not really. If you were paying attention, that would have been very simple. Well,
maybe I wasn't.
No.
It's boring. Science-y. So, okay, next question.
We're not going to get to question
Question
three
number
yet.
Two. Right. Now we're talking about rosé.
Okay.
Is rosé just a mixture of red and white wine until you get the colour that you want?
No, apart from sparkling wine, where you can add a red wine, still red wine, to get the colour you want. But with still rosés, you press the red grape varieties and some white grape varieties if you want to, but you press it very lightly, so you only get a little bit of the colour from the skin, but you don't blend a red wine and a white wine.
So darker rosé has just been left on its skins for a bit longer.
Yes.
Question number three.
Was that easier? Was that better?
Yes.
Okay.
Question number three. What is orange wine? Going through the colours of the rainbow.
What are you referring to, like a skin contact?
Yes, wine? Skin contact.
Okay, so
which people, the customers might come in and ask for orange wine, which would mean a skin contact wine.
Okay, so you follow the process of making a white wine, which is crushing the grapes, getting the juice. But then you start to treat it like a red wine and keep the juice on the skins of the white grape varieties. And if you have a darker sort of grape skin, like a Pinot Gris, you get more of a copper colour. The longer you keep it on the skins, the darker the colour is, and it tends towards an orangey colour.
And they tend to have a bit more of the red wine characteristics, don't they?
That increases the level of tannin and structure and grip in the wine, so it becomes a bit more chewy. Sometimes people might say they are just tannic and no fruit, which is often the case if it's not a very nice one. And that would be called a skin contact wine.
Sometimes you just need, I think you should seek advice on orange wines.
Yes.
There are some good examples and some not so good ones, like any other wine.
Yes, there might be an official version of what orange wine is, which isn't mine. But in reality, that's basically what it is, I would say.
And we have got quite a few on our shelves.
We have, yes.
Nice.
Yes.
One. But they taste like the grape variety. I think that's when we don't enjoy them so much, is when they lose the characteristics of the actual grape.
Yes, I think you approach it like any other thing. You taste a bunch of different ones and you pick the ones that you think are nice and interesting and good value for the price. That's what we do with reds and white wines, and don't just buy an orange wine just because it's orange.
Or it's got a funky label.
Because you might think you're trendy, but you're not.
Okay. Question number four. Am I on four? Yes, I didn't number these, actually. What is fortified wine? Give examples.
Okay. Fortified wine is a wine where you make a normal wine, like we've just discussed. Then you halt the fermentation process by adding in industrial strength spirit. An example would be port. Port has to come from the Douro Valley in Portugal. It's a demarcated area and it's protected. Much like the area of Champagne is protected, if you want to call your wine Champagne. You get the fermentation, the natural fermentation takes the wine to 12%. You then add a clear neutral spirit, which is a bit like
grappa.
Yeah, but grappa, where people say they don't like grappa, is not very nice. I've tasted it. And that that's about 70%, and it brings the wine up to 20% alcohol, and ports are labelled 20% alcohol, but that addition of the spirit kills the yeast, so it can't eat any more sugar, so there's some sweetness that remains in the bottle of port, and it's obviously stronger than a normal wine. And when people might read that you add in a grape brandy, you're probably picturing Remy Martin or Courvoisier or something. You might not be, but it doesn't look like
it's
that.
Not
it's
that.
Just clear and it stinks. Well, it doesn't stink, but it's quite aggressive on the nose, the alcohol.
You don't want to be drinking that on its own.
No. Something like sherry is made in a different way, but which we don't really need to get into too much, but the alcohol addition, again, stops fermentation, but for the example of a Fino sherry, brings it up to about 15.5%. Another example would be Madeira, that's a fortified wine. Muscat reef salt, if you drink sweet wine in the south of France, that's a fortified wine. And there are many others. The port styles in California and South Africa, made in the same way as ports but can't be called port.
Nice.
Okay.
That covers that one.
I think so.
Number 5. Mm-hmm. What are sulfites in wine? Are they bad for you? People always say they get a headache from sulfur, and it's a bit of a tricky subject, I would say.
Okay, you're allowed to add sulfur to wine production legally.
And sulfur is a naturally occurring byproduct of wine production. So there is a small amount of sulfur that's always produced.
Even if you've not added sulfur to your winemaking, there will be a tiny parts per million. They might be, say, 8. I don't know what you're allowed to have in a normal wine, but say it's about 100, and lots of producers will bottle at about sort of 30, 40 parts per million. But people would add sulfur at different stages in the wine production to protect the wine from oxidizing and to keep it sort of safe and healthy. And
so it's a preservative, you would add to packaged foods.
Yes.
But like I always say, there's like compared to a bag of dried apricots or something where the sulfur is enormous amounts and orange juice and stuff.
Yes.
But there are lots of wines that where some people are adding lots of sulfur to preserve it because maybe the fruit quality hasn't been as good, maybe.
Yes, you could probably do that. Lesser quality wines. It's the same with everything. You know, if you're a chef, you're not going to put a load of rubbish in your food. And it's the same with winemaking. If you're a conscientious winemaker who wants to make the best possible wine you can make, you're not going to throw a load of extra sulfur at it just for no reason. So it's measured, and this is a producer's income. Each harvest, they need to get it out safely and cleanly. So if you don't use sulfur at all, there's an element of risk that you're not entirely sure what direction the wine's going to take, how stable it might be. So it can be risky, and that could be your year's income if you cook it up.
Like natural wines, they don't tend to add a lot of sulfur.
No, they don't. But I would argue that most good producers don't tend to add a lot of sulfur.
I was going
to
say, in fact, all of the wines on our shelves have not got huge amounts of sulfur added.
No.
And organic and biodynamic wines certainly don't add a lot of sulfur.
I'm well aware that people do have intolerances to sulfur. So that's one thing, but people sort of guessing that that's what's caused them a headache, or that's what's caused them, I don't know, whatever people complain about when they have too much sulfur. I don't know how you do that, and how do you know how many parts per million? We don't know. We sell the wine and we don't know how many parts per million of sulfur.
Well, we can find out, but we know that our wines haven't. They're not just pumped full of sulfur to preserve them.
No,
because the quality, it's a level of quality. So if you are sensitive to sulfur, then I'd say that you definitely should be seeking out an independent wine merchant to go and get advice from.
Yeah.
And find some lower sulfur ones or some quality wines. So possibly buying wines made in massive volume, in bulk, are possibly adding a bit more than some of the smaller producers who do things a lot more holistically.
Yes, and I think sometimes when people react to wine, I think that there's some issues with histamines, aren't there? And
yes.
I know a lot of people in the trade, they do regularly take antihistamines.
I think you should be taking them. I think that's what makes your cheeks flush.
You think that's what makes my specific cheeks flush? They've been flushed since I was born. It's
okay.
Healthy. It's a healthy, chubby boy.
Okay, so that was quite a controversial one.
Yeah.
Probably get an email about that.
Yeah. If anyone listened, then we might get a complaint.
Like the last one.
Yeah.
Question number 6. How long does wine keep after opening a bottle?
Oh, I don't know.
We get asked that quite a lot. It depends how...
It depends on your household, how quickly you drink.
We normally suggest a couple of days is about right, but also that you can put red and white and rosé wines all in the fridge, so that will preserve them for longer once they're open. So if you put the cork back in it, or put a stopper in the top, not a spoon or anything else.
So we got to question six before you've started answering your own questions. This is exciting, isn't it? But I said good point, because we had some leftovers from our staff Christmas party, which we held in August, and
you drank them all the next day.
But I didn't drink them all. No, 2 days later. two days later, and a couple of them were fine, and a couple of them were really not worth drinking, so I took them away.
They may have been left out on the side, and then I whacked it in the fridge.
Yeah, we didn't look after them particularly. There were only little bits left in the bottoms of the bottles, so it's not like we were wasting a load of things. But
half a magnum.
That didn't show so well, but that was a wine that was 28 years old, and we probably kept it in the bottle for too long, to be fair to that one. And so that style of wine tends to fade quite quickly. But if you had a strong, powerful bottle of port, that would last longer because it's more robust and it's bigger. But you're right. I think, like, once you've opened a packet of food or something, it will start to oxidise, it will deteriorate, and it will be fine for a little bit, then it won't be fine, and then it will go off. That's the process.
You can turn it into vinegar.
Yes, you can.
That's a good way of not wasting wine.
I think you need a starter thing, don't you, for that?
I don't really know, but I think it's quite a good idea of non-wastage.
Yes, good idea.
Where are we up to? Question number seven. Now, this is another controversial one.
Lucky number seven. Come on. Kenny Dalglish's shirt number. Best player in the world ever. Come on.
All right. What is a corked wine? Is it when bits of cork are floating in my glass?
No.
We get that brought back. We've had quite a lot of bottles returned where someone's opened it with a spoon or a potato peeler or something, and the cork's gone all in it, and then they've said it's corked. And then they want us to swap it for another one.
Yeah, mostly it's because the person doesn't like the wine, which is a bit disappointing, isn't it? You wouldn't send, well, I suppose people do send food back, don't they?
Yeah, but you wouldn't take it back to a supermarket, would you? You don't buy a bottle and go, I don't like that, so I'll walk it back into the supermarket and tell them I don't like it.
I don't know what they do, but we can't do anything about these people.
Anyway, that's not the point.
It's affected by a bacteria thing called TCA, which is a really long word in full, and it sort of attaches itself to cork
in the winery
and creates unpleasant smells and sometimes unpleasant tastes in the wine. The wine deteriorates. But it's good actually if we've got an actual corked wine, which we pull a lot of corks, and that's not a euphemism for anything, that's just our work. And there's very, very few corked wines, I would say. And it's made a difference because lots of them are screw caps now, but we lots have corks, and when we do get one, we keep it because when you smell it, you know what a corked wine is.
It smells like damp cellar. That's what I always think. I mean, people say wet dog.
Yeah, wet car, like wet dog wrapped mold. In wet cardboard.
Smells musty and mouldy.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it's a fault. It's not anything to do with how you open the bottle or having a bit of cork in your wine or anything like that.
I think it's a bit like an unripe green apple where it's really sort of, oh no, that's a bit...
Yeah, but that's not faulty, is it? It's just unripe.
No, that's what it reminds me of. The problem is that some corked wines are only a little bit corked. So there are gradations where it really stinks at one end, and to the normal person, it's imperceptible at the other end. And then there's an in-betweeny bit where you think there's something not quite right with it, but I can't be bothered to take it back, so I'm going to drink it anyway.
You've done that a few times, and you get to the last glass and ask me to smell it, and I'm like, that's really corked.
It's not really corked, though, is it? But
because you've got all your histamines going.
You notice it more, probably, if you've got a wine that you drink regularly, and then you might notice that a bottle on an occasion is not how you pictured it to be or how you remembered it tasting. And sometimes that's down to the individual, your mood, how you're feeling. You know, there's elements of that. Your glass might be dirty, a bit stinky, or the wine might be corked.
And the bigger picture problem is that for a winery, that could affect a whole batch of wine. So that's tricky for a producer.
Yes,
so if you've got that in the winery and it's attached to all the corks in a certain batch of wine, and they all get sent back, that's quite problematic for them.
I think the other aspect of this is how you deal with it afterwards. So if you have got a corked wine, and it's like a modern vintage, so it's not something that's 50 years old or something, there's a problem with it. Be polite, don't be a dick. That's a good rule in life.
Now we've got to put an X-rated warning on this.
No, it could be a boy's name. And and then you'll get a good response back. If you just wade in and say this wine's corked and it isn't, then there's absolutely no reason why we should replace it.
No.
We do sometimes, but you'd like to make a lesson out of it, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, that's why I like to keep an actual corked one there so people can smell it.
Yeah.
Okay, question, we're only on number 8.
Mm-hmm.
How long should I keep a wine? How long can you keep a bottle of wine? And do all wines get better with age?
I would say that they
depends on the
do.
Wine, doesn't it?
They probably do. Yes, it does depend on the wine. So
it doesn't. They don't all. If you just buy a real young... If you're buying a Vino Verde...
Yeah, but I think once it's from day one to, let's say, day 24, I think it mellows down a little bit, maybe.
Yes, I'm saying, is it like, if you keep all your wines, they're going to gain in value and they're going to get better?
Not the case. So each wine has a curve, a life curve, where it starts at ground zero. And then it goes up the hill on its steep curve and it improves. And then there's a point where the crest of that curve, where it peaks, and then it starts to deteriorate.
I know, you're doing all the hand gestures. No one can see
you. Well, that's why I'm using the terms curve, crest, and upward slope. So a wine, like a Vino Verde, a one that's made to drink quickly, might have a lifespan of a year. Where it starts to get better and then it starts to deteriorate and gets a bit flabby. A wine like a big red, like a Brunello, that curve might go on for 20 years. So you've sort of, and it's horses for courses, so there's no point keeping something for 10 years if it's only a wine that's made to be drunk in the first 6 months or the first year of its life, because it's not going to get better. It'll become rarer, but no one will want to buy it. Because it will be shash. But some wines will get better and better and better. And if you've paid the price now, in theory, that's a lot cheaper than if you had to pay that very same wine in 20 years. So that's the rationale. And you must seek advice. You know, we do it, we're in it, and we get it wrong, don't we? Not very often, but there are wines where...
Some are a bit of a gamble, aren't they? And you can get a wine that's supposedly going to get better in a certain amount of time. And we have a lot of old wines on the shelves as well. And sometimes they are past it. So that's why we sell them, was kind of sold as seen. Could be a risky one.
Well, that's the thing. And I think if it's price to go, price to be drunk and price that you can take a gamble, you might say you might pick some wines from a wedding anniversary year and keep them because your reason for keeping them is to have them on each of your anniversaries. Even you might even know that that's pointless, but that it's worth the fun, and it is fun, and you're finding out, you're paying to find out. And so I think manage your expectations, play it down, and then you can only have...
Seek advice.
Yeah, and seek advice. If you want to do it seriously, then you've got to throw some money at it, and... I think it becomes a bit boring because it becomes more like a commodity and your people buy things that they know are going to gain in a lot of value and they resell those and that buys other stuff. But I think that you can lose the fun element then and the love of the actual juice, which I think is all important.
Okay, that leads nicely on to the next question of, does price really matter when buying wine?
It matters because... The price of everything matters at the moment, but I think value is a better way of describing things. All things have to have a price, don't they? Because people have to be paid, and people have to, you have to ship the wine around the world. You have to, the producer needs to be paid. They've got bills to pay. The people who sell it have to be paid. So all of these things will add up.
But you can get some good value wines where all of those, we even our cheaper wines, which probably start at about $7.99 these days.
Yes.
We make sure that the wines, that the money is going back to the winemaker.
Yes. So once you get above a certain point, say you like say 12 or 15 quid, the proportion of that bottle as a percentage, which goes to the actual producer, which is important, is starts to make a difference. When it's like a £5 wine,
I don't even know how you could do that.
They get whatever they get, 10p or something.
Nothing.
So there's not a lot of incentive then to make your wine the best wine in the world, because you're doing it probably by numbers. You're probably trying to create a large brand, which is price sensitive. So I think it's like you just pay the fair price. Have less, but better. Same with clothes, same with food, same with everything.
And I guess we do get customers who come in and we've got some wines on the shelf that might be 400 quid a bottle. And they say, why would anyone spend that, and what justifies the price of that bottle?
Yeah.
I mean, there's quite a lot of factors that would go into that.
Well, if you've got, I imagine that Elton John is really rich, and if Elton John was really still thirsty, a £400 bottle of wine might not mean anything. You know, it might be.
No, but the
money might just
the
be.
The price
irrelevant.
Of that bottle is justified in the fact that it's smaller production from top vineyards with top fruit, with top winemakers, where the land is really, really expensive. And the winemaking, the production takes a long time. There's lots of things that go into it to justify why things cost that much.
Yes.
There are other things where historically they've got a big name, so they're just...
Yeah, prestige and collectability or status, and they're the sort of cynical parts of that price. But it, with that sort of money, you could assume that every tiny bit of detail is taken care of, and often by hand, and over again. And there's they probably will only make the wine out of I don't know what it will be, say 40% of the total harvest, where they consider that the very best fruit, the very best oak perhaps,
they might make 400 bottles
something
for the world for the year, and that's a one-off. But there's lots of things that would justify it.
I think if it, you know, you're either a cynical person and you're looking to pick holes in things, or like me, you're an enjoyer and you find the positive in anything. So, I just don't buy it if you're worried about it. And everyone will have a cut-off point, won't they? We see it in the shop. Some people won't want to pay over 10 quid. Some would see a £100 bottle as a treat, but they can't justify going above that. And some people spend more than that. So, you know, there's something for everyone, isn't there? That's the beauty of it.
Okay, next question. Mm-hmm. What does vintage mean?
That's if it's got a date on the label, like 2021, for example, that is the vintage, and that is the date of the harvest of the fruit that went into that wine. If it says non-vintage, it's... general, like champagne, it will be a blend of two or more different harvests, so different years.
And there are some specific vintages which are meant to be particularly good.
Yes.
Why is that?
Because they are years where the weather is perfect. So that goes from each year, you sort of start from scratch again almost, because you're growing a plant and it starts off as a stick. If you go and walk around a vineyard in the winter, you're looking at twigs, really. But then the little buds come out in springtime, and then the flowers, they turn into bunches of grapes, and then you've got to get those ripened, and you've got to harvest them in nice conditions where it's not rainy, so it doesn't dilute your fruit, and no pests, no bugs, no mold. So when all of that goes well, and the balance of the contents of the grapes, the sugar, the acidity, the tannin levels, and the ripeness of the skin and the pips and all of these sort of things, if it all comes together, that would be considered a great vintage and a wine that would taste nice to start with and probably taste nice for several years.
Next question. What are legs when people talk about them in a glass of wine?
That's the staining on. If you swirl the glass of wine around and there's the wine clings to the glass, they call it, they refer to it as the legs. I'm never really sure why, but it's glycerin content.
High alcohol, high sugar.
Yeah, so we had a bit of port at the weekend, didn't we? And that's very deep purple. Have a nice viscosity to it, and it clings to the glass, and everything is super sticky, and that it almost doesn't come down the glass, but it doesn't mean that that's any better or any worse than the crisp white wine that had no sugar in it that we had previous to that, which doesn't cling to the glass and doesn't have any legs. And often you might get legs because you haven't washed the glass properly.
Or high alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, number 12. This one could take a while, but keep it simple. What makes a wine vegan?
Okay, that's, you know, once you've made the wine, the producer might want to filter it or fine it, which is to
make it clear,
make it bright, and make it more attractive in the bottle or the glass when you open your bottle and drink it in a restaurant or a bar or whatever, and you don't want a hazy wine. And there are different ways of doing that, and some of those ways are using animal parts.
Egg white, mainly.
Egg white and part of the fish gut.
They don't use that anymore.
I know, but they did historically.
Yes, and that's why it gets a bad rep.
But it is only... I appreciate you're either vegan or you're not. You can't mince around, can you?
I am pretty much vegan.
Not the other. So you eat fish. So it's good to know. But the other way that people can do it is filter it through clay sort of screen things of different things.
Mainly they use egg white if it's not vegan, and if it's vegan they use clay.
Yes, bentonite clay.
How many bottles of wine do I need when I'm hosting a party, wedding or event? Get asked this daily.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you do, because we have our certain amount that we recommend for a tasting, or
you look at your audience though, don't you? And you there's absolutely no way of knowing whether people are going to drink more white or red. You don't know in this country.
It depends on the weather.
You don't know what the weather's going to do. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, even in this month, it's been really wet and a bit miserable, or it's been super hot and dry. So you just got to pick where you think your audience are going to be. And you know, if someone's coming in, they know their audience better than we do.
If we're doing a wine tasting, though, in the shop, for example, or we've supplied wine dinners, which we've done quite a few recently, we normally allocate one bottle for 10 people, which gives you a fairly generous tasting portion.
Yeah, that is a tasting.
You get six small glasses of wine from a bottle.
1, 2, 5s.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's how we kind of do the maths on it.
Yes.
So then depending on how many glasses you think people are going to want, or if you want everyone to have a small glass of wine with each course, you can allocate one bottle per six people.
So you can do that with your toast, can't you, with your fizz. If you're at a venue, they will probably pour you in a little flute a 1, 2, 5 pour.
If you're lucky.
If you get a full glass. Mm. So there's six of those to a bottle. You just ratchet those up to the amount of people that you have, and then throw on a bit more for the bits that have exploded or people have spilt, and you might want to have a little top up. So you just do the maths on that.
Historically, you should take advice on it, I would say.
Historically, people have recommended half bottle per person, but the weddings that we've been to have not been a half bottle per person.
Not when we're drinking.
We had one recently, didn't we, where that person, no names, no pack drill, allocated three bottles to every single person who was in attendance.
Yeah, we wanted an invite to that one.
Which, you've got to bear in mind that there will be people there that might be pregnant, who aren't drinking, they're going to be
driving.
Drivers, people who don't like drinking. So someone's taking up the slack on that one. That was a good party. That sounded
really good, and they had some nice wines as well.
Yeah.
Does the quality of glass really affect the way a wine tastes?
I think so.
I know you love drinking out of a jam jar or a tin.
Oh yeah, I love that. Yeah. Why would you do that? Absolutely no reason.
Yeah, but
there
are lots of nice fancy bars where you go to and you get like a mug.
Yeah, it was stupid. It's style over content. It doesn't make any sense. And I tell you why. I tell you for why. Because you can't smell anything out of that. If you pour wine into a mug, it really dumbs down the aroma. In my opinion, when you drink it out of a nice glass, they are a pain because they break. And then when you have to replace them, they can be quite expensive. But I've got some nice glasses at the moment that I've really enjoyed using. And they are a little bit specific to grape varieties, but I've tried them with other wines in them and they do smell and taste different. So, and I don't need anyone else to use these glasses. I just really enjoy drinking.
No one's allowed to touch them.
No.
Don't even know where they are, hidden.
Break them. but I think just look at the standard industrial sort of ISO wine glass is good. And you can get those in different sizes. But it allows you to swirl the glass around, keeps it in the glass without spilling. You get good aroma from it. It drinks nicely, hasn't got a big thick rim. And I think it does, it makes it, why wouldn't you drink out of a nice glass if you can? I don't understand why you...
I guess if you're buying a nice wine, you should have a nice glass.
I think if you're buying a nice wine, you should do everything in your power to make it taste the best you possibly can. It's the same as if you bought a nice piece of fish. You know, to do everything to make it taste as best you can.
Fry it.
Really? Cover it in sauce.
Last question.
Okay.
Where can I learn more about wine? This was a leading question.
Through our podcasts, because they're amazing.
Going into our shop, talking to our excellent staff.
The real more important question is, do you really want to learn more about wine, or do you just need to be told what you should buy? I think people sometimes say they want to learn about wine. I want to learn how to speak Italian, but I've done absolutely nothing about it.
That's not happening.
So it's the same with wine. Pointless. You've got to put some hours in and you've got to learn some basic facts. But I think it's a... I continue to learn about the subject that I'm in, and I've done it for my whole lifetime, effectively, which is 53 years. Born in a restaurant, gone from there. So that's the beauty of it, is that it gives you a lot of enjoyment, rewards, contacts with people, chance to socialise, chance to share nice things. But I think that the best thing to do is to narrow down what you like and what you might like, and try and eliminate wines you're not going to like. And that's by tasting, asking people about it, reading up about it, having some fun with it. But you can't drink every wine in the world in a lifetime. So
I think you're doing your best though, aren't you?
I am doing my best. I'm taking one for the team. But... yeah, you go to independent shops, you go to tastings, you go online, you read books, all of the above. Go on wine courses, come from college, go to his net.
Independent merchants such as ourselves.
And listen to excellent podcasts.
And we have lots of blog posts and such so you can find out lots of things. Or come and talk to people.
Our team are very well trained, so their blogs have been really good recently, I would say. Some of them I don't bother reading, obviously, but these ones have been really good quality. So, yeah.
Plenty of options.
Yeah.
All right, that's it.
Okay, did I pass the test? How many did I get right?
Oh, dear.
Actually, we must say some of these might not be factually correct, but they sounded good in my answers, I thought.
They are correct.
They should be.
But there's...
If you don't agree with one of the answers...
Don't email us.
No, because we won't listen.
Right, thanks. Have a happy holiday.
Yes, make it last forever.
Not long now until it's back to school and back to work, which is what we've got to do now.
Thanks for ruining that. Right. Bye.
I hope you got all that. Doodle pip.